Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to talk about key observations from the Air Force Association's recent Airspace and Cyber Conference. We're going to talk about what made news, what provoked thought, and what did people fail to notice but should have. And just to bring you up to speed, the Airspace and Cyber Conference is held every year in September here in Washington, D.C. If you have anything to do with air power or space power, it's the place to be. The entire leadership cadre from both the Air Force and Space Force are in attendance, along with thousands of airmen and guardians. It's the place where services release important news and test drive ideas. It also provides insight into what leaders are thinking for next year's budget. And also, I want to point out how much we really enjoyed meeting so many of you who listen to our podcast. We engage with a lot of you, and it was great to get your feedback. Plus, it gave us ideas for new episodes. We also want to say a special thank you for all of those that stopped by our booth. You know that we have a new Aerospace Advantage patch that we gave away to our loyal listeners. For our listeners who missed out on the first wave of patches, we'll be rolling in on an Aerospace Advantage patch giveaway during future episodes of the podcast. Stand by for words on how to get your hands on one. Now, the Mitchell Institute always hosts a number of panels at the event, so we're going to hear from our team members who were on stage last week. So with that, we've got Lieutenant General David Deptula.
Hey, good morning, Slick.
Major General Larry Stutzream.
Hi, Slick. Good to be back.
Heather Penny.
Hey, Slick.
And Mark Gunzinger.
Hello, Slick.
And also Chris Stone.
Hey there.
All right, everybody. Thanks so much for being here today. General Deptula, let's get started with you. You've covered several panels, and what were the topics and what were some of your top observations?
Yeah, thanks, Slick. I had the good fortune to moderate three panels. The first one was entitled Force Mix of the Future, and I had on the Air Combat Command Commander, Air Mobility Command Commander, and Air Force Global Strike Command Commanders. And it resulted in a pretty conventional set of comments from each of these leaders, emphasizing the need to modernize their respective forces. I think General Cotton from Air Force Global Strike Command made a very articulate case for the importance of the ground-based strategic deterrent as extraordinarily necessary to replace the geriatric Minuteman III, particularly in light of the recent knowledge and awareness of the Chinese rapid growth of their ICBM force. Now, the next panel I moderated was on defending the homeland. And I had the commander of U.S. Northern Command, General Van Herk, Admiral Chris Grady, commander of U.S. Fleet Forces Command, and Lieutenant General Steve Whiting, commander of Space Operations Command. And I'd tell you here, the standout takeaway from this panel was General Van Herk's comment that while there's great focus on China as the pacing threat, in actuality, Russia is our greatest nuclear threat and presents real challenges in terms of homeland defense, given the array of nuclear weapons delivery means. The second point, and it's a very important one, is how do we posture ourselves for a double peer nuclear threat as China gains the same level of threat capacity that the Russians currently have? Now, a corollary that was not addressed at the panel, but should be raised during the next nuclear posture review, is whether the current administration should have been so quick to agree to a five-year extension of New START. But I'll leave that discussion for another day. And then the third panel I moderated was surprisingly the most well-attended, with three rows of folks standing in the back of the largest room at the convention, and the subject was the 2022 National Defense Strategy and Future Force Structure. We had Melissa Dalton, who's performing the duties of Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy, Plans, and Capabilities, Lieutenant General Gus Castella, the Air Force Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, and our very own retired Colonel Mark Gunzinger, Director of Mitchell Institute's Future Concepts and Capability Assessments. On this panel, Gonzo started off with an excellent presentation of our current national defense strategy and why it needs to change. Then what was a standout was Lieutenant General Gastella's commentary, where he delivered a powerful rationale for why the Air Force is in growing demand and therefore requires a greater share of DoD resources. It was a rare display of Department of the Air Force advocacy for air and space power in this era of joint political correctness, and very needed. So it was great to hear, and Gastella made some great points. Overall, I think that there was a lot of energy at this airspace and cyber conference. The SECAF remarks about his three priorities of China, China, China were well done and made the point, and very welcome were his sincere remarks on why he believed that air and space power were going to be the key forces in any future conflict. Furthermore, he stated, quote, "Our one team cannot win its one fight to deter China or Russia without the resources we need and a willingness to balance risk today. We are out of time." The chief gave a very powerful speech on not believing in the impossible and encouraging Air Force personnel to take the initiative and not wait for direction. I just wish he would have made as strong a case for the need for the Air Force to receive a greater share of the DoD budget, since it actually has suffered the greatest cuts among all the services over the past 30 years, yet its Air Force capabilities are in greatest demand. He did say, "We cannot wait for a catastrophic crisis, whether it be sudden or insidious, to drive change for the Air Force as well as the Joint Force. If we do, it'll be too late." But the question left unanswered is, what change is he calling for? So, great conference overall, and thanks for the opportunity to provide those insights.
Yeah, Mark Unzinger here. That was a great summary, General Diptua. I'll add one point. I heard something this ASC that I have not heard previously from Air Force leaders. Almost to a person, they talked about the need for penetrating long-range strike, fifth and sixth-gen penetrating fighters, fifth-gen munitions to accompany those platforms. It was very clear they believed to win a future fight with China, we need those next-generation systems.
All right, I appreciate that. Thanks, sir. Stetson Gonzo, what about you? I understand you two were both on a panel together discussing our cost per effect concept.
Yeah, let's set some context on that, on this title, The Need for DoD Cost Effectiveness Analysis. We know this, we all know this, there's a growing strategy to resource mismatch. You know, that is, there's a gap in the difficult mission demands ahead, and then having the capabilities and capacity to meet those demands. And there's a very dangerous world around us, a very cloudy budget environment. So how do you get the most bang for the buck? And we're talking about combat bang. And how do you compare competing solutions from a combat effectiveness perspective? So I tell you, Gonzo, you presented an incredibly effective briefing on this topic, and I think we need a little primer on it. Can you give us a 1 minute on a cost effectiveness analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. It compares the costs and the effects that can be created by different capabilities with the intent to maximize the value of desired outcomes in the battle space. It really doesn't require a business degree to understand cost effectiveness analysis, because, you know, the average American does it every day as a comparison shop for a new car or other item they require. So why isn't it a standard practice for determining how DoD should modernize? Now, problems arise when the Defense Department makes modernization program decisions that are based on budget-driven factors, such as a new aircraft procurement and flying hour costs instead of their combat effectiveness. And the F-15EX, which we covered in the panel, is one such example. Stutz, as you recall, OSDK briefed us on they completed in 2019 that led to DepSecDef's decision to direct the Air Force to buy those new old fourth-gen F-15EXs. Mm-hmm. And you also recall that CAPE's analysis compared flying hour costs, unit costs, and other budget numbers associated with the F-35A with the F-15EX. So when we asked if they had considered operational considerations, such as the comparative effectiveness of 4th and 5th gen fighters in a fight with China and higher 4th gen fighter attrition rates, we were actually stunned when the answer was no. Warfighting effectiveness was not part of their analysis, right. And that is analytical malpractice in anyone's book.
Well said. So let me just summarize three highlights, and then we'll throw it around the table here. One major theme that came out of the panel was the need for a better way of explaining combat effectiveness to the Hill. Otis Winkler, who's a professional staff member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he explained he looked through several past National Defense Authorization Acts, and he found no less than, I think it was 100 cost terms, yeah. You know, like cost per effect, sustainment cost, and so forth. And he explained it's like Congress is searching for a way to understand warfighting worth, especially when comparing other systems. And Wayne Schatz reinforced this from his perspective as the Air Force A9. He owns the analysis enterprise for the Air Force. He saw a need to advance cost per effect analysis and the need for better modeling and training, but he was especially zoned in on the value of cost per effect analysis to better explain to Congress what the Air Force needs. So let me play this one audio clip from him.
And I'm convinced that if we can't tell our story right with the solid analysis showing that, hey, here's the maximum warfighting effect we're going to get for the things that we want to buy, and that, guess what, we're actually making good stewardship of our nation's resources, we're not going to be able to convince the people across the river to fund those things for us. So that's why, that's the why here. That's why this is critically important.
Yeah, that was powerful, Gonzo.
It was.
Yeah, lastly, there was a focus on the use of cost-effectiveness analysis across the defense enterprise to make cross-service. And Gonzo, you talked about cross-domain and cross-service choices. And Gonzo was masterful on this one, and I'm not going to let him say it right now. We're going to play an audio clip because it's perfect. Go ahead.
The problem I had was talking to my leadership about where the best value for the dollar would go, because we got competing programs coming from all the services saying, well, we can do this and we can do that. So we can't do it all. We have to make decisions on how to allocate resources. Where is the data? Where are the studies that can do that? Well, the fact of the matter is many of those cross-service, cross-domain even analyses were never done. That is something I believe the Joint Staff absolutely should do. Because if our senior military leadership can't get together and do those kinds of cross-service analyses that can figure out how can we maximize the combat power of DoD as a whole, of the Joint Force as a whole, not stovepipe by stovepipe, service by service, who's going to do it? The Deputy Secretary of Defense and Secretary of Defense? Really? Do you want the senior civilians department to make those decisions for our senior military? I don't think so. So it belongs in the Joint Staff or another joint organization to do those kinds of analyses. There's just not enough of them today.
That was quite a drop the mic statement, Gonzo. So I'll throw it around the table. Thoughts?
So about several years ago, maybe 8 to 10 years ago, when I was doing strategy division stuff in PACAF, one of the discussions we had was an article that came out about this topic in Air and Space Power Journal about cost effectiveness per effect and how it should be part of strategy making in theaters, not even just at the level that you guys are talking about. So I think it's interesting that it wasn't done there. It's not done at the theater either. When it comes to actually using all these equipment and munitions and things that you're talking about buying, it also isn't happening at the lower level, at the theater level either, for execution.
Yeah, I think we had a discussion at the panel as well that talked about this isn't just a DoD issue. It's an issue for the GAO, for the Congressional Research Service, and other organizations that assess DoD's programs and future investments. Because they also base those analyses primarily on how much things cost instead of how much will they be able to provide to a warfighter in the future.
Exactly, Gonzo. I mean, I think that the panel that you were on really hits the nail on the head, because the focus is too much on cost effectiveness and not enough on mission effectiveness. And the fact that CAPE, in doing their program evaluations, has been in many ways willfully neglecting the mission effectiveness piece is gross negligence in my mind when it comes to their responsibilities to the warfighter.
Hey, that's well said, Heather. It's hard to add anything after that, but wonderful summary of the challenge that we have. And the fact that, some of these organizations in OSD are hindering rather than helping the way ahead, particularly in an era where we're going to have increasingly constrained resources available for defense.
You know, I'd like to just add one more thing on the mission effectiveness for the cost per effect. What it would also require is that we have much more rigor and honesty when it comes to our wargaming. Because wargaming is how we're going to be able to measure the postulated combat effects of these new capabilities and new requirements. But if we're not going to actually hold those wargames to the duration, if we're not going to actually constrain ourselves in the way that we really will in the real world, and also provide realistic threat scenarios and threat capabilities, then we're distorting the outcomes of those wargames too.
Yeah, well, let me jump in there too. I mean, as you're talking about realism in wargaming, that harkens me back to over 20 years ago when wargames were used as some of the means to determine outcomes of the Quadrennial Defense Review. The problem was the wargaming methodologies are simply attrition-based, and they don't take into account effects at all. And we still have not advanced our simulation capabilities to do so, which is a whole nother discussion area, but good point.
And especially, General Deptula, as we look at concepts like JADC2, ABMS, Wayne Schatz brought this up, that we don't model those sorts of sophisticated future warfighting concepts of operation. That's a problem.
Right, because it doesn't, what you do in a cyber domain or command and control domain or anywhere in the context of electromagnetic operations domain, it doesn't show up as a bunch of little green guys on the opposite side of some terrain as either being decreased or not. So that's one of the issues we have. We have to modernize our simulation tools and incorporate more than just attrition-based modeling.
Well said.
All right, well, Gonzo, I'm going to ask you to pick up the mic after the mic dropping moment. You also led a strategy discussion with some of the Pentagon's top folks in this area. And what were your main observations there? You obviously released a paper on this earlier this year.
Yes, this was part of General Deptula's a panel, and I must say that was the most interesting panel, I thought, in my perspective, at the ASC. So let me start by saying that DoD's defense strategy includes guidance on how the services should size and shape their forces. And that guidance includes a theory of victory for a fight with China and Russia, which is the focus of the strategy. Now, one problem with the 2018 defense strategy is it assumed China will not fight a longer war with the intent to exhaust our military's greatly diminished capacity, even if we defeat the PLA's initial assault, say, on Taiwan or in the South China Sea. So if we size for a short war, that gives China a path to victory that would, frankly, devastate our ability to deter future threats and assure our allies throughout the Indo-Pacific. So we recommend that DoD's next defense strategy require the Air Force, the Space Force, and the Navy to size for a longer conflict with China, primarily because a fight with the PLA in the Pacific would be air, sea, space, and cyberspace remain dominant. The second point, we'll also recommend that DoD return to a two-war force sizing requirement, because sizing for one war presents a second peer aggressor with a path to victory. Specifically, the Navy Marine Corps should primarily size for a fight with China, because as I just said, it will be air, sea, space, and cyberspace main dominant, not a boots-on-the-ground conflict. The Army, on the other hand, should primarily size for a European fight, Since defeating a Russian invasion of the Baltics or elsewhere along NATO's eastern frontier would be land, air, space, and cyberspace domain dominant. But as you can probably tell from what I just said, the Air Force should size for both theaters. Since only Air Force air power can respond in hours to strike invading forces and take the offensive to the enemy, again, within hours of a start of the fight.
Yeah, well said, Gonzo. It was an exceptional panel in that people were listening with anticipation, I guess, of what was going to be discussed. Again, you did a great job in laying out what needs to be done. Now we'll see if the Department of Defense does it.
Yeah, I agree. Gonzo asks all the right questions, but he also answers the key questions. And we'll be watching to see how that's reflected in the next round of documents. But that was a very well done presentation.
Well, and I just also like to add that I think that the notion of a prolonged conflict is absolutely crucial. I mean, today we are so thin because we've been focusing on efficiencies for the past 30 years that we don't have any kind of strategic reserve, whether or not that's a strategic reserve of weapons or a strategic reserve of people or a strategic reserve of platforms. We just do not have the strategic depth to be able to not simply blunt a first action with China, but be able to attain victory over the long term. So the notion of time, I think, is absolutely crucial.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the priority for the next strategy should be sizing the Air Force and the Navy for a longer war with China. A two-war force, I think, is essential. But if I had to prioritize the two, we need to prepare for that longer conflict.
And also on the Space Force side, you can't, as we've said many times, you can't do all this on 2.4% of the DoD budget.
Here.
Yeah, General Deptula answered a question masterfully on that in the pass-through for the Air Force.
Yeah, it's interesting. Such a different narrative than what we see today, which is an attitude of everybody plays in every engagement. Everybody is encouraged to have long-range strike. We understand in the good analysis that was done, there's just not enough budget down the road to be able to build the force we need to be able to handle either of those theaters you discuss, Gonzo.
Yes, but selectively grow the size of the force. As I mentioned, DoD as a whole needs a two-war force, not every service.
All right.
Okay, Heather, I understand you discussed force design, which is a topic you've explored in a lot of your writing.
Yeah, thanks, Lick. So on the first principles of air power panel, we hosted Generals Hinote, Richardson, and Nahom. So it was great to have these three together. They're really the triad of Air Force modernization. You have requirements, acquisition, and budget all in one panel. Overall, they stayed on their talking points. So no real surprises there, but it was refreshing to hear Air Force leadership, and this was something that we saw throughout the conference, Air Force leadership publicly and explicitly say that we've lost our margin of advantage against peer threats and that parity is not a future issue. It's a today problem. So for those of us that lived through the Gates years, where the Secretary of Defense ridiculed Air Force leadership for being future-looking, it's a relief to finally be able to speak reality out loud so we can get to the work, the hard work, of building a future force design. So one pivot that I did hear from General Hinote was his statement that we can never have enough bombers.
When we think about global strike, the first thing we heard the Secretary talk about, the B-21, we are going to need penetration in our bomber force. We are going to need survivability.
Yeah, so we will need to have penetrating bombers, like Gonzo had pointed out on his previous panel, penetrating bombers, and that we will need to have lots of them. Now, of course, as the money guy, we heard General Nahom say, as a budgeteer, I can tell you there are enough bombers because he's looking at it from a budget standpoint. But it's refreshing, again, to hear Air Force leadership state their requirements, not just simply what their wide budget numbers actually are. And for those of us who'd been following the previous AFWIC work closely, so this was the team inside the Air Force that was looking at requirements, previously, it appeared the Air Force had really been leaning more towards standoff capabilities rather than penetrating assets. And again, Gonzo completed an important study on this, highlighting the need to get inside the threat to prosecute targets and to be able to do that over time, that we cannot rely entirely on standoff weapons. Again, there's simply not enough of them, and they're too expensive. The cost imposition equation gets reversed, where it's more expensive for us to be able to prosecute if we are totally doing standoff. So I'm also reading a little bit between the lines here, but I can't help but think that conflict duration, and again, we talked about prolonged or protracted combat, is finally starting to play in some of these war games and studies that the Air Force is doing. So let's listen to a comment from High Note later from the session on sequencing over time.
So there's very much a sense of time and thinking through time as to how we can stand up against a true peer competitor.
Yeah, so I have long been concerned with our ability to sustain combat for longer than 2 weeks. And I mentioned this, as we were talking about Gonzo's previous panel, that we just simply do not have the strategic reserves of weapons, pilots, platforms to be able to sustain any kind of long-term conflict. And I think the notion that we'll bring any peer conflict to resolution in our favor within the short time frame that most war games look at is very naive. I think, honestly, we lose and we lose for some time before we really begin to win. So we need to be able to have the strategic reserves to be able to press through that time frame, because we won't even have a chance to get to winning if we don't begin to think for and plan for protracted combat. And finally, I think something that was really important was General High Note's comments on artificial intelligence and our need to be able to scrub and quality control the data and training that those systems are getting.
What's going to end up happening is China's going to try to corrupt that database, and we're going to do our best to corrupt their databases.
Yeah, so that's going to be a key component, not only for our defensive capability, but also for our offensive capability. I'm not so sure, though, that it's going to be entirely humans that are going to be doing this kind of quality control, because we know from previous experiments and from other human-machine teaming operations that artificial intelligence and machine learning provides really surprising outcomes. So what we'll need to be able to do is take that validation verification that normally occurs before the milestone C and actually have validation and verification as something that is an ongoing process inside of operations, so that we can then detect when we're getting fed bad data or bad training and then be able to quarantine those bad actors. But this is going to be a technological thread that we need to move towards, because we haven't solved it now.
Yeah, let me make one comment on time. I alluded to the fact only air power can get to the fight in time to stop an invasion by Russia or China. When I'm talking about time, I'm talking about the fight could be over in the Baltics within 4 or 5 days. The fight could be over for Taiwan in the same amount of time, based on RAND war games and so forth they talk publicly about. It's going to take weeks for naval forces a sortie from the continental United States into theater before they can join the fight. Army forces, if they're in a CONUS, it's going to take weeks to months before they can get to the fight. But only air power, including long-range bombers, can respond within hours and start laying down those high-intensity strikes on invading force the same day a conflict happens. But it's not just denying those forces. They can also go deep into China and start attacking those missile fields, those bomber bases, and inflicting pain and punishment on China to convince them that they need to stop and stop now. Only air power can do that.
That's right, Gonzo. And if we don't have those kinds of penetrating bombers, if we don't have that in the capacity needed, we're not even going to be able to set the conditions for a later on victory.
Right.
Now, Chris, you're a resident space power expert, and you hosted some of the top Space Force leaders in your session. And what do they have to say?
Yes, thank you. I was privileged to lead that panel on Tuesday afternoon. And on that panel, we had Lieutenant General Whiting, the commander of Space Operations Command. We had the commander of Space Systems Command, Lieutenant General Guetlein, Mr. Roberts from Space Rapid Capabilities Office, and a late add of Brigadier General Whitney from SAFSQ, which is the Acquisition Integration Assistant Secretary Office. The title of it was Space Acquisition to Lethality. And so running into that, a lot of people seen with from the questions from the audience were expecting to talk more about obviously acquisition, but also the lethality part. And obviously, since three out of the four folks on the panel were acquisitions professionals, obviously it was pretty heavy on the acquisition side. But one interesting thing that I'll mention, and then I'll get to the second and third, is when it was General Whiting's turn to speak, he mentioned that unlike back in the day when Air Force Base Command was still around, that force design and requirements are no longer done by them. They're done by the SWAC, or the Space Warfighting Analysis Center. And also, Space Systems Command is not just meant to do acquisitions, but it's meant to focus on the threat, as General Guetlein said. So there's a difference there on that. A lot of the speeches or comments, rather, from each of them were primarily about how they're getting after the acquisition situation. And pretty much most of them all agreed that having authorities move down the chain of command from the highest side to the lowest levels, whether it's a program executive officer or a program manager way down below, is they want that to move quicker. In order to do that, you have to push the authorities down. One interesting other thing that I noticed was a quote from General Guetlein regarding a phrase that he used.
The last thing that SSC and the Space Force are bringing is a unity of effort. We are attacking unity of effort across all fronts. There are now two forums that have stood up at the four-star level. One is the Joint Space Warfighting Forum. That's between Dr. Scalise and U.S. Space Command General Dickinson. They collaborate on all the warfighter requirements, and we have a seat at that table. On the material side, the organized training and equip side, we stood up the Space Executive Committee that's chaired by Dr. Scalise and by General Raymond. And underneath that is that Program Integration Council that you keep hearing about. The Program Integration Council is huge because it brings to the table Space RCO, SDA, DAF RCO, MDA, NRO, and SSC all at once to have a conversation about how to get after the threat from a material side, but it also gives General Whiting and General Shaw a seat at the table to give us the warfighter requirements.
So this is why I bring up that quote. Is one of the main reasons for the creation of the Space Force was consolidation of acquisition organizations. Congress has been saying this for years with reports and studies and things, that there's too many organizations. And there's one other quote that somebody mentioned to me in a sidebar conversation during the conference, is that there are actually more organizations now than there was before Space Force was created, engaged in acquisition. And as a result of that, you're hearing a lot of that as becoming a talking point among senior Space Force leaders, whether it's the vice chief or the chief of space operations saying, yeah, we're really not getting after the consolidation thing. We want a unity of effort. So we're kind of getting back to that old days of the Defense Space Council, where all the different people with different equities regarding programs and policies and things of that sort are getting together to discuss a way ahead. And even though, you know, as they said, they're rowing in the same direction for the first time ever, I'm not sure Congress is going to be totally excited about that because of the push. And even with SDA moving into the Space Force, you still have Space RCO, SSC, and all these other organizations that are popping up and all that. Finally, is there any comments on that?
I was there, Chris, and you did a great job, by the way, on that panel. It was a great discussion. I was somewhat disbelieving of the discussion on unity of effort because unity of effort does nothing unless you have unity of command. You know, we are warfighters, not business collaborators. You know, we have to have this consolidation because it is about that principle of war and using that force to achieve objectives in the battle space, right? So I just, from my past, when I was on active duty, you know, I was involved for a couple of years with the Weather Enterprise. And an example of unity effort among the other agencies of federal government and Department of Defense is very frustrating. It's very slow. In fact, modernization of the space architecture, I think, three times in a row was, you know, just finally just ran out of steam because there couldn't be an alignment of requirements and what the outcome was going to be in terms of hardware and space. So I would hope that we hear more about the consolidation and we hear more about unity of command with respect to Space Force. That's why it was put together.
Right. And the other issue is that a lot of people gleaned on to a quote from SAFSQ's Brigadier General Whitney when he quoted the Dalai Lama saying, in order to break the rules, you need to know what they are. And because he'd been in the Pentagon a lot, he was joking, half jokingly, which later became a question from the audience of how do you expect to break the rules? Like, what are you planning to break to make things better? And he looked a little surprised, I think. But
He was very surprised.
But he did a decent job of saying, you know, we need to make sure that we can, you know, figure out what things we need to move quickly and which things there are extraneous that we don't necessarily have to worry about in the near term. But lastly, one other thing I noticed is space acquisition to lethality was how a previous discussion that we've had several times on this and other podcasts is overclassification. Which got in the way of a discussion I was hoping to have with this panel, which is the space lethality piece. I mean, obviously, it's one thing to talk about providing support to air, land, and sea warfighting forces from space. It's another thing to talk about the independent options, deterrence, and warfighting piece that Space Force was created to organize, train, and equip for. And we really didn't hear a whole lot about that, other than we're getting after the threat kind of language. They didn't really say too much. And the reason they gave me when I asked about this was just because of classification situations and they weren't ready yet to go there. So I'm hoping in the near future, with rumors circulating around about reveals and things of that sort, that we can actually start seeing some more public discourse from Space Force on how they're getting after the actual space threat and not just how they're getting after supporting terrestrial warfighting.
I think that's a really fine point, Chris, because, you know, we really need to see the Space Force become something more than the military's cable guy. And to be able to truly exploit the space domain, the focus on space lethality will be key.
Yes. And it would also just help a great deal in both integration of joint forces to be able to provide more than just, you know, optimization of SATCOM and GPS flex power and all the standard stuff we've been doing for 30 years. It's all great, it's all important, but until we see some kinetic and non-kinetic effects being thrown into the joint plans, a lot of people are gonna continue to question what's the difference between Space Force and Air Force Space Command.
Exactly, and we won't be able to achieve the future operational concepts and true integration of space lethality until we address a lot of those classification issues and then get into exactly what you just said.
Okay, let me wrap up this commentary by reminding everybody that the highlight of the entire conference was the Mitchell Institute receiving the prestigious Air Force Association Chairman's Aerospace Education Achievement Award. And this award is for long-term commitment to aerospace education that makes a significant impact across the nation and, in fact, around the world. So I had the privilege of accepting the award on behalf of the entire Mitchell Institute team, and it was a great tribute to the hard work and dedication that's gone into building the Mitchell Institute over the past 7 years. And to our audience, continue to support us, and we'll see if we can't continue to take home that award.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.